thanks for joining us. Before we start the show, I want to wish Wilma Mae Rudisell a happy birthday. She turns 100 years old today. Good for you. In the studio today, we have IRS Special Agent Brian Watson and owner of Copper Canyon Tax Service, enrolled agent Mark Barnes. And I want to tell everybody, you want to know Mark, you don't necessarily want to know Brian.
That's true.
And I want to thank you guys for being here so early in the morning.
Good morning, Sherry.
Let's start with Mark. I know I've heard people say, oh, I'm going to have this tax service do my taxes. That way, if anything's wrong, it's their problem. What do you say to that?
That's not necessarily true. If you're mailing in your tax return, you're signing it, and there's a bunch of words right over your signature that I'm sure most people ignore. And if you're going to file your tax return electronically, you're required to sign an 8879, which is my authorization to disclose your information to the IRS. And you're signing under penalties of perjury. And it says, I declare that I have examined a copy of my electronic individual income tax return and accompanying schedules and statements, and to the best of my knowledge and belief, they are true, correct, and complete. So at the end of the day, you've signed off that your return is correct, that you believe that it's correct, and that the responsibility comes back to the taxpayer. The audit would be with the taxpayer.
But the numbers come from the taxpayer.
Most of the time, the numbers come from the taxpayer.
Here's my information. I put it together. You're putting the numbers on the lines that it belongs on, and we're good to go. And if you're lying about your numbers, then oh well.
This is where we're asking for documents. We're asking for W-2s and 1099s. We're asking for copies of your bookkeeping so that we have the information that we need to be able to prepare it correctly, but also to ask additional questions and do our due diligence to make sure the things that you're reporting are things that are deductible, things that are legal. And it also gives us the opportunity to find things that maybe you've missed. But yeah, at the end of the day, it's your tax return. You've signed off on it. And if you forgot something, it's your responsibility.
And that's where, you know, if you've got two sets of books, one for the IRS and one for your, you know, yourself, there's a problem there. And that's where Brian comes in. And you don't want to meet Brian, although he's really a nice guy. But you don't want to meet Brian under those circumstances. What have you found situations like that?
Oh, we double set of books?
All
the time. That's something we get very excited about. We actually, one of my favorite stories I like to tell is going on a search warrant, and it's, you know, it's not like Law and Order where you're in and out in 5 minutes. It's, you're there all day, and you're going through filing cabinets. And I remember on one search warrant going through a filing cabinet and found a file that said tax returns. Said, okay, I'll look at this, because you look at everything. And you open it up, and there were two sets of tax returns for the same year, same person, but there were some numbers that were slightly different. And there was a post-it note on each tax return. One tax return said for IRS, and one said for bank. Well, guess which one had the higher adjusted gross income? The one for the bank, because you're applying for a loan, and the one for the IRS was probably the true one that was much lower. That's something, as an IRS special agent, you get very excited about.
Yeah, you just, you know, it's a pot of gold.
It is.
Let me ask you, you're talking about, you know, currency. What is this crypto stuff? I don't understand that.
Cryptocurrency is a digital currency. So it's not like the paper that you have for dollar bills. It's something that lives and exists on the internet. The best part about cryptocurrency is the blockchain technology that, for all of us, is really going to help us in the future with a lot of things, from protecting us from, you know, bad food that floats around, because it'll be able to track everything from the seeds to the grower to the transporter to the warehouses. It's going to speed up things like mortgage applications, because we'll be able to verify data instantly. But at the same time, it's keeping track of every time this currency has moved, changed hands, been traded. So all that information is out there. So cryptocurrency is this thing that people can pay for stuff. You can pay for your coffee. You can buy a car with it. And every time it moves, it's been tracked. And again, it's not paper. It's not a credit card. It's this currency that lives online in the cloud.
So I've never had anybody come to me. You know, I'm a loan officer, and handed me a bank statement with their cryptocurrency on it to apply for a loan. I'm not sure how I would handle that.
Generally, you have to have a separate account. It goes into what's known as a wallet, and you have a digital wallet. So it's a completely separate account. Coinbase is one of the larger U.S. Locations where it's traded. And so you'd have an account at Coinbase, and that's where you would do your trading and buying and selling. There are places where you can get a debit card that's attached to this wallet so that you can shop normally at a grocery store, Starbucks, or wherever. And each time you swipe the card, it sells off a fractional share of your currency to pay for whatever you're purchasing.
How would you follow that, Brian, if somebody has an account like this? How does that affect your job?
It is the wave of the future. And unfortunately, I'm a little jaded towards virtual currency because I just see a lot of criminals using it for the anonymity that comes with it.
Right.
It just makes things more difficult. We actually have, in my field office, several special agents who are specifically trained to look at the darknet cases. And so I want to make it clear, just because you use virtual currency, cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, I mean, there's all kinds of different names. There's thousands of them, which very random ones you've never heard of. There's nothing illegal about it, and it is the wave of the future. But unfortunately, it does make it more difficult for us because criminals use it for privacy, for anonymity.
So if somebody gets into your account and takes all your cryptocurrency, how do you report that?
Well, it's traceable, right, Mark? I mean, you got to protect your password. That's the biggest thing.
Yeah, it's traceable to a certain extent. I know there may have been more, but I know of one case where somebody had their account hacked and all the money was moved, and that's basically it. It's the same as if you had $50,000 of cash in your mattress. If somebody walks in your house
and steals your mattress,
steals your mattress and all of these, you know, dollar bills that you have, it's gone. It's not like you can call the credit card company and say, hey, these aren't my transactions, or call your bank. Like, once it's gone, it's gone.
There's a lot of fluctuations. It's very volatile. Cryptocurrency is very volatile, and it's not FDIC insured. So that's where some people will never ever do it. You know,
yeah.
I actually did a presentation recently at University of Arizona in accounting class, and this very smart young man came up and asked me, when do you think the government will ever accept virtual currency as payment? Like, can you pay your taxes with it? And right. I thought it was a very profound question, because let's say you owe $5,000 on your tax return and you paid $5,000, but then it's so volatile, all of a sudden it's worth $2,500 the next day, or maybe it's worth $10,000 the next day. It's not for the faint of heart. You got to know what you're doing. But I think like Mark was saying, we're moving in that direction. So it'll be very interesting what happens in the next few years, 5 years, 10 years.
So you can transfer your cryptocurrency to somebody thinking it's worth $5,000. By the time they get it, it's worth $2,500. You're still screwed. You have to.
Yeah, might be an exaggeration, but
no,
the whole point
still.
It changes.
Like when I transfer funds from my account to another account, I know that's the amount of money that's going in there.
Right, right.
So it's guaranteed.
Yeah, the value of it does go up and down. So we have an account. You could pay for your tax return with cryptocurrency. Our account is set up at the end of the day to convert it to U.S. dollars. So we're not actually going to hold the cryptocurrency. You can pay with it, but at the end of the day, it's going to be converted to U.S. dollars so that we eliminate the fluctuation, because I don't want to own it as an investment. I don't mm-hmm. think it's a good investment idea.
Could I pay with Monopoly money?
No.
Oh, I just thought I'd ask, because I have some of that. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guests today are IRS Special Agent Brian Watson and the owner of Copper Canyon Tax Service, Enrolled Agent Mark Barnes. And we're talking, of course, about taxes in different situations. Mark, have you ever fired a client?
Yes, we have.
How and why?
Well, so one, we have to understand there's a limited amount of time between you receiving your documentation and April 15th. So we have to maximize this time. And years ago, as I started getting busier and you start getting to that point where you're at capacity, you have to kind of put an order to your life. And so I had to think about the things that were important to me and how I wanted to prioritize any event that happened. And it's fairly straightforward. On the top of the list is my family. Second is my staff. And then third is the client. So when someone comes in, I have to look at this situation, what it is that you need accomplished, and is me taking this on the best decision in that particular order? Is it the best decision for my family? Is it the best decision for my staff and then the client? I'm never going to put the client above any of those other two items. So at the end of the day, I need to be able to go home, look my family in the face, know that honestly, deep down inside, I've done the best job that I can. So dealing with people that, you know, Brian may show up at their office, these aren't necessarily the kind of people that I want to deal with on a day-to-day basis. You also have people that are rude, the energy vampires. So there's a bunch of situations where, you know, we just really, we're not a good fit. Whether there's some kind of conflict in personality or you're very vocal about something that's not necessarily important to preparing your taxes. You know, example, if you want to spend the entire meeting telling me how much you hate taxes and you hate the government, this probably isn't going to be a fantastic relationship because I have a job to do and I can't get it done when you're complaining.
And actually, you and Brian have the same job. When you think
sort of.
About it, you both want people to pay their taxes.
True. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah.
So
we fired a few people over the years. We prefer to call that disengaging, not firing.
Oh, okay.
But we've had people in the office yelling at staff, which I find unacceptable. We have people that just through random questioning have self-identified as not reporting all of their income. They may not even know that they did that while I was talking to them, but you know, these are the kind of situations where you know enough to tell me that you are doing something that's illegal and yet you don't want to correct it. So this isn't going to be a good fit for us.
Yeah, so that makes sense.
Depending on what kind of a relationship we're in, we will send a formal disengagement letter and then life goes on.
A formal disengagement letter. I like that.
There are services that we provide to people that have deadlines, things where federal tax deposits are going to be due, especially for payroll. And so just because we're disengaging doesn't mean that I want the client to be put in a bad position. I just want you to be in someone else's office. So we will send the engagement letter, disengagement letter, and we'll identify all the upcoming events, what the due dates are, what the consequences for not taking action on those items is. And then it's their job to go somewhere else, but they can't come back and say, well, you never told me.
Very cool.
You signed the mail when it
CYA.
Showed up.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
You signed the green card when the mailman showed up. If you failed to actually read what was inside the envelope, that's beyond my control. But we did let you know everything that was happening.
Very cool. That's, yeah. I just wondered because I know sometimes people can be not very cooperative when it comes to paying their taxes, and there's always things there, obviously.
And we're dealing with the general public, so you're dealing with people from all different lifestyles and backgrounds and religious beliefs and political beliefs, and you're not going to get along with everybody that's out there. And at the end of the year, we only have so many people that we can produce tax returns for. And I don't have time to fight and argue with people.
What recently happened in Green Valley?
This may be more of a question for him, but this comes back to the question of who's responsible for your tax return. And most of the time, it's the taxpayer. But there's going to be situations like Green Valley where we have somebody who was clearly just making up information, putting it down on the tax return, pitching this as a service of he knew something that the rest of us apparently were unaware of, and he found himself being visited by Brian.
So the case that Mark's referring to is, I have a copy of the indictment here. This is an indictment out of district court, because that's where our cases, federal district court, where our cases are worked, are investigated. William Stearns basically owned and operated a tax return business in Green Valley, Arizona. It was called Stearns Tax and Accounting, and he was indicted, so these are only charges. Hasn't been proven yet, but the allegations are that he filed federal income tax returns with the Schedule A, that's your itemized deductions,
okay,
with the IRS for his clients, which claimed improper and or inflated unreimbursed employee expenses as a deduction against the income. So right now it's just, it's an indictment and it's in the legal process, and he has, you know, all of his rights, and we'll go forward. And usually what happens, pretty much one of three things: we either will go to trial, he'll plead guilty, or the government will drop the charges for one reason or another.
Okay. So,
but we work a lot of these cases. I mean, we work a lot of tax preparers, because, you know, the vast majority of them are honest and ethical, like Mark, run a clean shop, they want to do the right thing, they have good clients. But we actually work these preparers. We had one this summer, a guy named Joseph Vosberg here in Tucson. He was sentenced to 18 months in prison, and he basically admitted to preparing 33 false tax returns that contained over $450,000 in false deductions, you know, to the point where he was encouraging people to make up a business. You know, say, well, what, do you have a hobby? Oh, I do photography. Well, let's create a Schedule C business where you can take a loss. So now in that case, his clients were not charged criminally, only the preparer was. And then we even had a third one this summer, a lady named Sandra Gamboa up in Phoenix. She's a tax return preparer. She pleaded guilty, admitted that she filed a false tax return for herself, and that also she's filing false tax returns for her clients, and she's been in the business since 2011. And unfortunately, we've worked a lot of these cases in the last 2 years. We actually, we had another indictment recently. I didn't bring the gentleman's name, but his name, yeah, Adon Ramirez. He was another gentleman who was filing false tax returns, and he was indicted. So it keeps us busy, unfortunately.
Are they sitting in prison?
Well, Mr. Vosberg got 18 months.
I wonder if he's listening.
It could be. Mr. Vosberg got 18 months in prison. And, you know, unfortunately, I mean, these cases are all different.
Yeah.
You know, but a lot of times it's just, a lot of times it's greed. It comes down to greed. They want to make money. You know, if you start getting more and more clients, you get more fees coming in.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, they'll, and also, you know, like one of the red flags we talk about during tax filing season is anybody that bases their fee on a percentage of your refund. We're not seeing those in these cases here. That's not the allegation, but that's just a huge red flag. Mark would never do that. He'd base it on how much work and time they spent on the return. It should have nothing to do with the refund amount.
Yeah, that's true. And I know years ago I went to one of those tax services that's there during tax season. They disappear afterwards. And I was simple return, single mom, simple return. But they went through every type of file or schedule and charged me like $200 for something that should have been a very simple return. And I never went back there. I can't remember their name. Their logo is green. What happens if your return is incorrect? Do you have the opportunity to fix it?
Yes, and we encourage people to fix it. My job, actually, part of my requirements are, if I review your tax return and it is incorrect, in writing you will receive what I see is incorrect, the corrective action that needs to be taken, and the consequences of not fixing that. And this is one of those where, when we see the cryptocurrency cases, you really want to fix this before the IRS fixes it for you. If we fix it, we get this submitted, yes, you'll owe tax, and we can address that and we can get that taken care of. If the IRS fixes that for you, then you're looking at the penalties that they're going to tack on for underreporting and underpaying, and those usually are 20% of the tax that's due. So by coming to see me and letting me fix it, you're going to save yourself 20%.
Have they ever had a return where it's over-reported? Under-reporting? Over-reporting?
Well, I've heard stories of people getting audited and there'll be a no change, or they'll actually get money back because they forgot something.
Right.
You know, so audits are not necessarily the worst thing in the world. You know,
we were talking about this. Can you be audited annually?
Yes, you can.
And tell us why, because I didn't realize until before the show that, oh, really?
So when the audit process starts, the IRS has to go through a process. They can't just wake up and show up at your door and audit you. They have to go through a process, and they have to request specific documentation from you. And this shows up in your mailbox, and it's called an information document request. In my world, it's an IDR, because everything is just a bunch of letters and initials. And that lists out all the items that they have the authority to come and look at. So this is that representation side of things where we're protecting your rights. You hire me, my job is to protect your rights. And part of that is they asked for three things. They're only going to see three things. So let's just use an example. 5 years ago, you were audited and they wanted to see your advertising expenses. And it's a business, not a person. And you were unable to produce receipts that backed up the amount that you had reported on your tax return, and you lost that audit. And the next year, they could audit advertising again. They could audit meals and entertainment or any variety of other things that appeared on your tax return. And they could audit you every single year for the same item if you continue to lose audits, or different items if there's a reason for them to want to come and take a look at this stuff. Now, where we can put the brakes on, if they're auditing you year after year on the same exact thing, and year after year it's a no change audit, there's a point in time where we can say we want this dismissed because you've audited this three times in the past and it's been a no change audit every year. But outside of that, yep, they can come and visit you every single year.
Repeatedly.
But the thing you have to realize too with the audits, we have limited number of auditors, revenue agents, tax compliance officers. There are some. There is a little bit of randomness to it, but most of them are figured out with something called a DIF score, and they're looking for where there's the most potential for fraud. Now, like, I'm a W-2 wage earner. The chance of me getting audited are very slim. Now, if I owned a Schedule C business, my own business, there's much more likelihood that there could be fraud, so you're going to go where there could be fraud. It's just a limited resources. You want to get the most bang for the buck for compliance.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We're going to be back in a few. Okay, we have in the studio IRS Special Agent Brian Watson and owner of Copper Canyon Tax Service, enrolled agent Mark Barnes. I want to talk to you for a second, Brian. What about this scandal with the college admissions?
Yeah, everyone knows about this. It's called Operation Varsity Blues.
Right.
And it's a huge case. I mean, you've just seen the media coverage on it. It's an FBI and IRS case. And I didn't even know about it until I actually saw the press conference, and there's the IRS special agent in charge out of the Boston field office talking about it. And I thought, well, I met her like last year when I was in DC at headquarters. And I'm like, I know her. It's a huge case. And then people are like, well, why is IRS involved? Well, it's a financial crimes case, and it's very complicated. And the U.S. Attorney's Office, basically, you know, they wanted to have FBI and IRS involved. And, you know, the sentences have, there was a gentleman this week that got a 6-month sentence. And then member Felicity Huffman, she only got 14 days. What's interesting is, you know, the average tax case, when we have a criminal tax case, the average sentence is 18 months. So this case is very small sentences, you know, for a variety of reasons. But no, it's made a lot of news, you know. It's been very interesting to follow it.
You know, it's really, I don't know how the judge feels about it, but I know as a citizen how I feel when I watch somebody who, you know, obviously did what they said happened, and they go, oh, no, I'm innocent. No, you're not. You're not innocent. And I think when she goes to court, the fact that she's like trying to backpedal and say I'm innocent, I think that's going to have an effect.
Right. And, you know, and every case is different, and there's different degrees. And I mean, I read the letter that Felicity Huffman had sent to the judge, and that she was very contrite, admitted what she did was wrong. And, you know, and each judge will evaluate each person differently. Some people will get probations. Some people will get a prison sentence.
Is there one judge doing this entire case, or is it in different courtrooms?
Yeah, man.
Do we know? I don't know.
I thought it was just one judge, but I could be completely wrong. I am not sure on that. I'll have to get back to you on that.
Okay. There was a takedown on the largest child sexual exploitation market in the world.
Yes.
Tell us about
this. So this was back in October. It was a website based called Welcome to Video. It was the world's largest pornography, child pornography site. And the person running it was a 20-something-year-old out of South Korea. And he's basically been charged here and there. This thing was huge, and over 300 people were arrested and charged nationwide and worldwide. Countries, a whole bunch of states here in the United States, and also worldwide. And the scariest thing about this was over 40% of the material on there was stuff the government had not even seen before. Because when we execute search warrants, whether it's IRS or FBI or HSI, we download what's on these pornographers' computers, and right. A lot of times you can do the hash value of those files and figure out it's something we know about. It's a known file.
Right.
Over 40% was new stuff. So this was creating a demand for new stuff. It's hard to even understand. I mean, I'm glad I'm not one of the computer guys that has to go through this stuff, but this was huge. It was the biggest one in the world by volume, and they were using the cryptocurrency to move in there. So that's why when I was speaking earlier at the show, I'm a little jaded towards the use of cryptocurrency, just because I know criminals use it for privacy and anonymity.
Yeah, I've always had a little bit of an attitude towards it too, because, well, it's not secured, but because of the way it's being used. And there's other stories about, you know, illegal use of this type of funds, currency, and I just don't think that's a smart way to go until things are improved. Okay, I'm reading these notes on here. Tell us about some of the scams, the IRS phone scams that are going on.
So the IRS phone scam's been going on since 2013.
It's the same recording.
It is, and they change it up. And I mean, I've gotten the call. My parents have gotten the call, but. We know of over $60 million that's been lost in the scheme. Key thing to remember, and that number is obviously much higher. The key things, IRS will not call you. Mark made reference to that earlier too. If you have an audit issue, you're going to get a letter in the mail explaining the situation. It's on IRS letterhead. We will never call up and demand money over the phone. So just think about that. Who could fall for a high pressure phone call? Who in your family, your friends, your neighbors, if they got a high-pressure phone call that said, you owe the IRS money right now, pay us, just hang up on these people. It's been going on since 2013. The reason the criminals keep doing it is because it works. So we are old school. We send a letter in the mail.
We have a case right now in the office that he passed away earlier this year, and she immediately started getting letters that taxes hadn't been filed for a few years. And as we start piecing all this together, like, my fear is that he got caught up in one of these things, because we have almost $300,000 that was present and they earned interest on a couple years ago and is completely gone now.
Oh, wow.
And it's a situation where, you know, he didn't file. I got the feeling he didn't file because they owed the IRS. And so it would be a perfect storm for one of these phone calls to come in. And so we got it. There's still some missing pieces here, but I'm afraid that this could be a case where they're a victim of this type of a scam.
Now, the monies that are lost like that, is that something you can take off on your taxes?
No.
Not anymore.
It's the situation where you did this voluntarily.
Okay.
It wasn't an
like
action.
A theft?
Yeah, it's not a theft where somebody broke. It's a theft, but if somebody calls you up and says, send us $5,000 right now, and you send them $5,000, that's like handing somebody your wallet, and, you know, you had control over the situation and you did it. You're the one that voluntarily gave the money without doing any additional research or doing any due diligence. So, and when we get to the tax side of things, the only things that are deductible now are events that happened in presidentially declared disaster areas. So even the standard theft rules that we had a few years ago, those don't exist anymore.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that. Maybe I can get my house declared a national disaster area.
Maybe. Call them up.
Call them up. Okay, Ingrid, what's on your mind?
Hi. Earlier you were talking about paying with Bitcoin, receiving payment with Bitcoin, and then you convert it back to dollars. How does that work? Who do you do that with?
So that's going to be something that happens through your cryptocurrency account and in your wallet. So at Copper Canyon, we have an account through Coinbase. So you could come in, have your taxes prepared, and pay us in cryptocurrency. And our account is just set up so that each day it converts to US dollars. So that's going to be something that happens inside of the account that you have established. And this account would be necessary for you to actually receive the payment in the first place.
Who actually gives you the currency, the American dollar, the money? Who accepts that?
It's done through your account. So when you think about cryptocurrency, it's property. So if you think about having an account at E-Trade and you're buying or selling stocks,
yeah.
When you sell a stock, it's converting it to US dollars. So that transaction happens through eBay. This is kind of the same thing where you're buying or selling cryptocurrency, and Coinbase is then the one that is providing this transaction for you where they're changing it to US dollars.
So there's an actual broker.
It's not necessarily a broker, but that would be the best way to describe it.
Okay, so somebody is taking the risk. They're going to take your cryptocurrency and give you greenbacks.
Effectively, yes.
Okay, thank you.
And it's not insured.
Yeah.
So, you know, you are taking a risk. Tell me about the Jamaican lottery scam.
Right, so... You know, as we've been talking today about a lot of high-tech scams, you know, in the wave of the future, but this Jamaican lottery scam is a very old-school phone scam, very similar to the IRS phone scam. These criminals, there are like criminal gangs in Jamaica running these operations, and they are getting lists of Americans. And they don't want lists of just any Americans. They want people that are over 80 years old. Why? Because it's elder fraud. It's elder abuse. And they call up and basically say, oh, you've won the Publisher's Clearinghouse sweepstakes when you haven't even entered it. You know, I actually got one of these calls. My cell phone lit up and it said Kingston, Jamaica. And I'm like, what? I don't know anybody in Jamaica. And they do. They get you on the phone. They get you excited.
And you don't even look a day over 95.
Yes. Well, I start asking too many questions and I think they realize I wasn't over 80.
Yeah.
And I mean, really, and so it shows you how evil these people are. I mean, they just basically want to rip off senior citizens.
Yeah.
And they get you excited, tell you that you've won, and then there's always the catch. You know, you have to pay some tax, you've got to pay some fee. And they rope you in. And we know of a case, people are losing thousands of dollars, $50,000, $100,000 or more. And we've actually, one of our agents here in Tucson's actually working with the other agencies here in town and internationally. He's gone down there. We recently had someone arrested down in Jamaica. We have more people that will be, but it's very interesting because it's the wave of the future of international cases. We're working with multiple jurisdictions. But the bottom line is this: if you get a call and they say you've won the Publisher's Clearinghouse sweepstakes and you did not enter it, just hang up on these people because they're gonna rope you in. They're gonna try to take money from you. But it's a huge case, and there'll be more publicity in the future on it.
Okay, we have a caller, George. What's on your mind?
Hi, good morning. I built a home that is not my primary residence. When I sell this home, what documentation would be best to provide in relation to the capital gains that we'll have to pay on the home?
So what you're looking at is, this is the standard on any asset that's purchased. You have all the items that are going to make up your basis in the property. So you're going to want to keep any receipts that you have for materials, receipts for labor, and keep all of these items for 3 years after the tax return has been filed where this property has been disposed of. But all these receipts are going to make up your basis in the property and will be what determines the capital gain that you have.
Hello?
I had not planned on selling the home, so I didn't save anything.
Okay. You're going to want to try to recreate what you can from that, because it doesn't matter if it's a year or 20 years. These documents are going to be what is going to back up the basis that you'll be putting on your tax return at some point.
Could I compile a good faith? In other words, could I make a list and take pictures and have that? Would that be the best form? That's about all I would be able to do.
In the audit world, there's really three levels when you get into that side of it. Having all of your receipts is obviously the best. It allows the tax preparer the best opportunity to make it a no-change audit. I would suggest that would be the route that you would take. There's going to be other items that you may not be able to get or reproduce, and then if the best estimate is what you have, then, you know, that's what it is. And if you get audited, somebody's going to have to pitch that to the IRS, and they either accept it or don't accept it.
How long do you have to save receipts for tax returns?
So anything that's on your tax return, you need to keep all of the documentation for generally 3 years from the time that return is filed. This number changes a couple of times. If you've underreported your income or underreported your taxes by 20% or more, or $5,000 or more, then it goes up to 6 years. If you filed a fraudulent tax return, that number is forever. And if you never file a tax return, the clock never starts. So all these time frames, the statutes never start if you never file a tax return. But under normal circumstances, what the items that are on your return, you need to retain that documentation for 3 years. This becomes problematic if you have something that covers multiple years. Me and my wife were just talking about this with some stocks that we bought in the 90s. We haven't sold these stocks yet, so we still need to retain this documentation until we sell the stocks. They get reported on this tax return, and then 3 years has lapsed since that time frame.
That made it really clear. I've always wondered about, you know, what documentation you have to save. George, did that answer your question?
Yeah, so I'm just concerned as to what type of, in other words, it was raw land. Now there obviously is a home there. The only thing I could do would be to compile lists and photographs. Would that be worth the, that's the only option I have available to me.
Yeah, I mean, that's going to be the best starting place for you, is to get anything that you can compiled to represent the facts as that you have.
That's better than nothing.
It's better than nothing.
Sorry.
When we get into nothing, then you get into the Cohan rule, and that one's really hard, and that one's really expensive, and it never is going to work in your favor. And that's basically, there's a piece of land and there's a house. We have to assume there was costs associated with this happening. And it's just not going to work in your favor.
Why is that called the Cohan rule?
Long time ago, I believe it was in the 1930s, there was an entertainer who kept no receipts, and his name was Mr. Cohan. And when this case landed in court, that was effectively his argument. You know, hey, one night I was in San Francisco, and the next night I was in Portland, Oregon, and then I was in Seattle. I had to travel. I had to stay places. I had to eat. So there had to be costs associated with me doing business as a performer. And then you're at the mercy of either the IRS agent that's auditing you or the court system on saying, yes, we agree with that position.
And it has to be a reasonable cost.
It has to be. It's going to be reasonable. And you'll be
$20,000 in hotel rooms.
Something like that. You'll be lucky if you receive 50 to 60% of what your actual costs were. And we never want to be in that position.
Okay. George, thanks for listening to the show. We're going to take a quick break. We're back. And in the studio, we have IRS Special Agent Brian Watson and the owner of Copper Canyon Tax Service, Enrolled Agent Mark Barnes. And I want to talk to Brian about his drug case.
Right. So you know, I work for the IRS and we work tax cases. And earlier in the show, we were talking about return preparers who've done bad things. But we also work a lot of the drug trafficking cases. And we had this individual sentenced basically this year, Omar Sabori Martinez, went to prison for bulk cash smuggling. And what he was doing, it was the opposite of the what happened in the movie The Mule with Clint Eastwood. Remember Clint Eastwood, he would show up into a tire shop or this repair place, and they'd load his truck with drugs, and he'd drive north. Well, the thing is law enforcement, a lot of the agencies, DEA, HSI, FBI, locals, and we're involved in that as well with the IRS, we try to intercept the money when it's coming back to Mexico, because that's where you hurt the cartels, is you take the money after it's been processed. But this individual, Mr. Sabori Martinez, he went to a tire shop in Phoenix a couple of years ago, picked up cash in an envelope, made another stop in Queen Creek. And this was interesting. He was on his way to Nogales, Arizona, and he was pulled over by the Pinal County Sheriff's deputies. Shows that how much federal and state work together and locals. It's
they
very
do
important.
Work together.
They pulled him over. They found almost $100,000 of cash wrapped up and concealed in the vehicle. And then here's the really cool part that I know is near and dear to your heart. Drug detecting canines alerted to the presence of the currency. Why? Because there was drugs emanating from it. Because a lot of times currency is not perfectly clean. It has a scent, a residue
right.
on it. So we love these drug dogs.
Oh, absolutely.
So that basically, without the dog, they may not have had the case. So this individual basically was sentenced to prison. And then three other individuals were prosecuted in this case, Manuel Castillo, Jean Hong Chi, and Zihao Guo, I don't know how to do it, all for money laundering. And that's how IRS gets involved, is we can get involved in these drug cases as long as there's a money laundering charge. That's our big thing, because we do taxes and we do money laundering. We also do some wire fraud. But it just shows that, you know, and that's how I got into this. I found out about IRS is I found out when I was in LA, the special agents in the LA office were taking down a drug organization, not from just catching the drugs, but following the money and taking the money. And that's where I was like, that's what I want to do. So
follow the money.
Follow the money.
Okay, real quick. I want to know if we're going to talk about reporting taxes. If you get tips, you have to report anything over $20. Is that per tip or is that annually?
So these are different sets of rules. Let's start with one. And we talked about this earlier. Internal Revenue Code, Section 61, all income is reportable. You get a $1 tip, it's reportable. The $20 threshold comes in, and that is an employer. You have to report to your employer on a monthly basis if you receive tips $20 or more. They're supposed to be adding this to your wages. Social Security and Medicare are supposed to be paid. So there's just two different sets of rules. Any money you receive, tips is taxable. If you receive $20 or more, you're supposed to report to your employer.
Okay. So if you're told, I work in a different industry and I have left companies because I felt that some of their business practices were unethical. And if your employer tells you, you have to give a tip to your processor or your underwriter or whatever that is, is that mandatory or is that a volunteer thing? And how do you report that on your taxes that you're paying somebody? And especially when they say it has to be in cash.
In cash.
Yeah. How do you report that on your taxes?
I have a lot of problems with that statement.
So did I. That's why I left.
From a personal perspective, you're an employee, you're not in business. Unless the company has a manual that specifically states that this is a requirement of your job and it has to be done in a certain way, it wouldn't have been a deductible expense anyway as an unreimbursed employee expense. That section of your tax return is gone now, so you wouldn't be able to deduct it anyway. But the mandating that you have to make such a payment and that it has to be in cash raises lots of flags, and they're all red.
And they're all red.
They're not green, and they're red.
Okay. The other question I have, maybe I should ask that one off air. And same arena, but a little bit different. You wanted to talk about something before we, about your passport being revoked?
Yes. So there's a provision. It's been out for a couple years. If you owe the IRS, it is now $52,000 or more. It's indexed for inflation. If you owe this money and you haven't taken the necessary steps to address this, your passport can be revoked. The IRS will notify the State Department, and they're going to, one, deny your application if you're applying, or revoke your current passport. We had a conversation in a tax group the other day, and somebody was like, hey, so what are they going to do? They're not going to let you back in the U.S.? No, they're certainly going to let you back in the U.S. They want to get paid. They're not going to let you leave. Ways to avoid this from happening if you do owe more than $50,000, set up an installment agreement, offering compromise, currently not collectible status, if you are active in bankruptcy, or if you're a victim of identity theft. All these things have to be reported, though. You can't just say I was a victim of identity theft and not file the affidavit with the IRS, not have made the police reports, and then all the other ones offering compromise are currently not collectible. These are things that happen directly with the IRS where you're addressing the money that you owe, and these will basically put you in compliance. It's the people that are not in compliance that are at risk of having their passports revoked.
I can't imagine owing the IRS $52,000. That just boggles my mind.
It happens for a variety of reasons, but you know, some people get in that position. But like Mark said, if you want to just engage with the IRS, don't ignore requests. Everyone can do the installment agreement, set up a payment plan.
Yeah, I've got a couple of people that have done that. Okay, next week, we are going to be talking with Jack Harris, and we're going to be talking about disgruntled employees and the red flags you should be looking for. I mean, there's all this stuff going on all over the country. People are just shooting up the neighborhood because they're upset, and I don't get it, but okay, you know. So we're going to talk about how to recognize those red flags. Give me your contact information.
Telephone number is 344-4149. Our office is located at Broadway and Swan, 4802 East Broadway Boulevard. The easiest way to find us is to find the giant building across the street where the Udall Law Firm resides, and we're in the tiny building across the street in their shadow.
And Brian, do people want to call you?
Sure. I mean, I'm in the federal building downtown Tucson at 300 West Congress Street. My desk line is 719-6232. And yes.
If you have any questions, yeah.
I'll point you in the right direction.
If
you have a criminal case for me, I'll be glad to listen.
Oh, yeah. Give him tips. If you see something, say something, right? Okay. I want to thank you guys, both of you, for coming in. And until next week, I want everybody to shop local and stay safe.